Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
On this episode of Inside Boxing Live, it is a very important episode because we're going to touch on fighter safety, traumatic brain injuries on the heels of Eidos Yerbosanili, who is in a medically induced coma. It's a conversation that needs to be had, and we're going to tackle it, as well as some of the headlines that are coming out of WBC convention. Some fights are being ordered, and also there are some fights this weekend. Not the biggest schedule, but some fights of note. So we'll get all into that coming up right next on Inside Boxing Live. What is up, my friends? Welcome into another edition of Inside Boxing Live, a production of John Boy Media. Dan Canobio, Chris Algieri, with you every single week. Producer Ronnie is here as well. Chris, hurricane bearing down again on Florida. You're not in your yellow rain suit. What is the latest? Can you give us a weather update?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very weak. It's Hurricane Nicole, more of a tropical storm than anything. But it should be touching down pretty soon, but we've been just getting just some wind and some rain. Nothing too bad.
Now that you're a Florida resident, do you find yourself knowing more and more about the weather?
Yes. Yeah, because it actually matters here. There's you know, we basically have two seasons. It's like brutally hot and, well, three seasons. Brutally hot, hurricane season, and then like the most beautiful place you could ever live. So.
And we're in hurricane season right now.
Currently. Yeah, it's on tail end. It's so weird to have an actual storm surge right now. It's so late in the season, but you know, it's been that kind of year.
Ronnie, how are you doing? Ronnie's Rocky review last week. I got tweets, I got texts, people were upset. I said, yeah. Listen, Ronnie's a real one. He's not gonna just tell you what you want to hear. He gave it to you straight. Like, do you have any regrets about such a harsh review of Rocky One?
Listen, we're a boxing show, but I'm not going to pull any punches. All right. So I will be straight with you. My opinion is nothing of note, but it's honest.
Yes. We don't have a Rocky review at the end of the show. We have a casual corner returns at the end of the episode. Of course, that's something we did for a while. But let's get into it, Chris. Obviously, not the best topic, but we always said once we put together this show, once you came on board, we're going to hit topics that we don't always want to hit. PEDs in boxing, one of our most watched and viewed episodes we've done on this, was very important. And another topic that I'm going to be honest, like I've done over 190 now of these episodes, haven't spent a lot of time on fighter safety. And that is because I think a lot of people in the media, a lot of boxing fans, a lot of people involved in the sport, I wouldn't say they like to sweep it under the rug, but they just kind of like don't want to talk about it. It's like some, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And that's fighter safety. That's traumatic brain injury. Unfortunately, this past Saturday, Showtime boxing card that I was doing the CompuBox for, and I was counting the punches, which made it even more tough to watch for myself. David Morrell, in the main event, 168-pound, I would say, prospect slash contender, really good, going up against Eidos Yerbosanili. And long story short, Eidos Yerbosanili is in a medically induced coma. He took a lot of punishment in the fight, one-way traffic throughout the entire fight, not a mismatch on paper, which makes things more complicated. But this is something that I want to spend time on, and it's something that isn't talked about a lot, and that's fighter safety, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I actually have spoken a lot about, maybe not so much publicly, but I've actually presented at the Ringside Physicians annual conference several times, and I've been involved with some research and some studies in the scientific world when it came to weight cuts and brain health and TBI. Done multiple talks at neuroscience conferences regarding head injury, TBI related to trauma to the skull from boxing matches, and how it relates to cutting weight and being dehydrated. It's just one of, like, exactly what you said. It's one of those things that people don't really like to talk about, but it's a harsh reality of the sport. We understand this is a very dangerous game, but more and more recently, it seems that we're seeing fighters who are either permanently affected negatively or, you know, are injured or actually die on very well-televised arenas, and we're seeing fights where that are on major networks where young fighters are succumbing to injuries in the ring. It just seems like it's happening more and more often lately.
Yeah, I mean, this is, we've said this for a while, like we have so many streaming services now. It's the golden age of watching boxing. Not always getting the best fight the best, but you can get these streams now. You can see fights more than ever. But on this segment here, I want to talk about what can change pre-fight, what could change on fight night, what can change after the fight. And in terms of this fight, a lot of things went wrong during the fight, and a lot of things went wrong afterwards. Almost a perfect storm of everything that could possibly go wrong, every mistake that could possibly be made when it comes to this. But just to go back to the fight, if you didn't watch it on Saturday night, it wasn't a huge card. So there are a lot of boxing fans, at least the ones that were talking to me or responding to my tweets, did not watch it. Your Bossanulli is an undefeated fighter. So it wasn't a mismatch on paper. David, they had a common opponent, and Lennox Allen, who your Bossanulli knocked out, who went the distance with Morell. This is a WBC secondary belt mandatory bout. Not a mismatch on paper by any means, but this was a mismatch in the ring from the fourth round on. From the fourth round on, after four rounds, your Bossanulli was getting outlanded 82-21. You could see there was discrepancies in talent. There was discrepancies in hand speed, discrepancies in defense. The first punch combination of the first round, Morell just pieced him up. His head was snapping back from the first round on. So in the sixth or seventh round, I was with my dad, and he's obviously seen a lot of fights, and he knows the signs. Complete face swelling, not just one isolated area, the complete face, which is sign number one. Number two, the blinking. Erratic blinking, nonstop. And we're seeing this. I'm seeing this from our office, our studio office on Long Island. How are they not seeing it at ringside? So eighth round, I'm like, okay, he's not going to win this fight outside of a punch from the gods. And they're just going to keep letting it going on. The corner didn't step in. The referee didn't step in. The ringside physician didn't step in. It was clear that he wasn't going to win the fight. It was clear that it was turning into a mismatch. 12th round comes. He gets knocked down. He gets up. He gets a point taken away for holding. He wasn't holding for an advantage. He was literally holding because he could not stand up anymore. So I'm thinking at this point, okay, we're already four or five rounds too far into this fight. Now they can stop it. He's been knocked down, stopped the fight. They let it go on. Gets knocked out bad to the point where Morell is carrying him to the corner, the fighter. How does this happen? He was failed by his corner, number one. He was failed by the referee, Tony Weeks, who's refereed huge fights. Ringside physician, it's literally your job to sit there and you're fixated on these two fighters. So that is bringing up the speed. Just all that being said, Chris, how many mistakes were made that night during the course of the fight?
You know, we spoke about this off air, and, you know, how many layers and levels of failure for the fighter that occurred prior to that stoppage, prior to the end result. Like you said, I mean, there's the corner, the referee. You know, you look at, you can't blame David Morell. Like, he was doing his job. His job is to go out there and look to destroy the man in front of him. It's the opponent's number one duty to not allow that and protect themselves. But, you know, fighters are tough. We're trying to win too. It's a competition, and you don't ever want to get stopped. You want to fight to the DRN, and going out on your shield is the honorable thing to do from a fighter's standpoint. So the fighters are different. You can't put the onus on them, but the referee's there to protect the fighter. The ringside physicians are there to protect the fighter. Your corner, you would think, would have some kind of emotional, psychological ties to the fighter and would want to protect them and see them go on. You know, like you said, there were so many telltale signs for a tragedy on the horizon. And, you know, so many of them were there. And like you said, there wasn't a way for him to win other than landing the big Hail Mary shot. And listen, I watched the fight. Eidos landed some good shots throughout the night. None of them seemed to really affect David Morell in a negative way. His defense was really on point. He was in absolute control. He was having fun in there and basically just had complete control after the sixth round. And by the end was literally calling the shots before the fight got ended. Those are all things that need to be taken into consideration when you're trying to decide whether this fighter can go on or not, because the consequences are dire.
Very dire. And who's left to deal with it? Obviously his family. But those who in the media like us, who we don't want to talk about this. I want to talk about fun stuff. I want to talk about fights. I want to talk about, you know, rumors. I want to talk about the ridiculousness of the sport. But it falls on like people like what we do. And it's another bad headline for the sport because ineptness. And you talk about, everyone likes to place blame. I understand that. It's part of our society. In this case, I'm not going to put a lot of blame on his corner because they're too invested in this. They're too emotional.
Yeah.
They're always looking for a way to, they don't want to concede. They just have too much of a vested, investment in the fighter and in the contest. To me, this boiled down to the ringside position, who I think should have a lot more say in this, because according to the rules of Minneapolis, and according to the rules of a lot of states, the referee is the only person that can stop a fight. So also the blame should also fall on Tony Weeks. Tony Weeks has been a referee for 20 plus years. He's been a part of some of the biggest fights in the history of boxing. What was he doing?
An excellent referee.
Excellent. Yeah, I think he's one of the top three. He's going to live with this for a long time, and I'm sure he is, because he's a lifer. He's a boxing lifer. The guy's a good dude. I've talked with him. Very good referee. What was he doing? What did you not see in there from the eighth round on that everybody at home could see? You know, go ahead.
No, I'm going to say sometimes these injuries happen, and I want to say it's a freak accident because it's boxing and you're punching each other in the brains. You know, like it happens sometimes where it just takes one shot and a fighter never recovers, never wakes up, is never the same. This was different. You know, this was different. This is a prolonged beating. And those are the fights generally that end in the worst scenarios. It's not the guy who gets knocked out in the first round. It's the guy who gets knocked out in the 12th round after he's been beaten up for the last 11 and a half rounds. And that's exactly what we saw on Saturday night.
Yeah. I don't like to use the punch stats as I don't want our punch stats to be used for anything other than what they're already used for now, in terms of, they don't even tell you can't pick a winner from them. They are literally for the fans and for the mm-hmm. broadcasters. But something that I've noticed from over the years of doing punch stats for fights is when you get into like the plus 100 difference in punches landed, which it was after the eighth round, 155 to 56. You're getting into a territory where the fight is out of control in terms of the B side trying to win, and it most likely being a beatdown. Because, you know, they say that UFC MMA is safer than boxing because you're most likely to get knocked out with one punch rather than an accumulation with the smaller gloves. This was an accumulation. It was disgusting. And the reason why I said I was like so upset about it is because, you know, I have a job where I literally count every punch. I felt like I was watching like a guy being like just slaughtered, like punch by punch. And it was like nothing you could do. There was no I felt helpless. I screaming at the TV and talking to some people afterwards. It's like they felt the same way. But I think a lot went wrong. And it's just mind blowing that all that he was failed. Like it's like three defenses. Like he was failed by all three. Obviously, the corner, which we said doesn't, you know, has like a vested interest in the fight. Ringside physicians. You spend time at ringside physicians at these seminars and whatnot. Shouldn't they? I think they should have a little more say in this. They're the ones that are literally brought in without any emotion. You're taking emotion completely out of it. Most of the time, these guys aren't fight fans. They're just hired to do a job. They're a licensed physician. They're doing their job. They're taking emotions out of it. I think they should have more of a say in this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't know I've ever heard of a referee not listening to a ringside physician who wanted to stop a fight. I'm not familiar with enough fights and being that close to understand that, but but generally I do believe that ringside physician should always have the say. And this brings up another point, one that we also have spoken about, you know, before off air, is that why is there not a unified rule set for boxing across the globe, really, but at least in this country? Why it falls on the state to state. Why would it be different rules for situations like that, where it comes to who has the final say for stopping a fight, whether it's the referee, only the referee can stop the fight, but then the ringside physician can stop it as well. I don't know. It's just another one of the problems that we have in our sport. And believe me, there's many, but this one directly affects the health and safety of the fighters. And that's a huge problem.
Yeah, so Yerbosanelli still in a medically induced coma. His promoter put out a statement, and the statement kind of, like, long story, it was hard to translate, but long story short, just pretty much said he's going to make it through. It's looking up, not life altering, not life threatening. But then there was a lot of people saying, well, if you're in a medically induced coma, isn't that, like, technically life, you know, life altering
for sure,
or life, you know, he's in critical condition.
Well, if you can never box again, your life is altered, especially if you're a professional fighter. That's what you do for a living. That's how you provide for your family. If you can't ever fight again, which I would assume that he will never will, that's life altering. So saying it's not life altering is erroneous fundamentally. I remember the first fight that I saw that really affected me in terms of a fighter safety. It was Magomed Abdusalamov who fought Perez in the Garden. Yeah. I was there live.
I was there too.
I was there with my brother, and I think I was probably 15 or 16 and 0 at the time. And I walked into my promoter's office and I quit. I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm not making enough money to, you know, I just watch a guy. Basically, I thought, you know, he was in a coma at the time. I said, I basically just watched a man die on Saturday night. Like, I don't make enough money to do this. This isn't worth the rest of my life with the way things are going. So, you know, get me a big fight or I'm done. You know, it worked out for me, obviously, but you know, that has always affected me, and it's something that I've hung with for a very long time. And that was another situation where the chain of command really let down the fighter. And I believe there was a massive, massive lawsuit regarding that against the New York State Athletic Commission, which changed a lot of things moving forward. But, you know, we're in a similar situation now where, you know, it's almost like the toughest of the fighter, it goes against them. You know, that's what the job of everyone else around them to do is. Fighters are supposed to be tough. This is what we do. We fight, and we fight to the end, and we try and find every way to win. But you got to be protected from yourself. Being too tough is a detriment.
Being too tough, having too brave of a corner. Corners rarely stop fights when they should be stopped. A lot of times when fights get stopped prematurely, I was stopped too early, throwing stuff. Like, rather it be too early than too late. And we're seeing that more in New York because of that fight a few years back where it was a $20 million lawsuit. It was the biggest lawsuit awarded in the history of New York State, you know, not just sports or anything. And it's changed the way that it's changed the way that fights are conducted in New York State. It's a lot stricter now. Fights end a lot earlier there. It's really hard to get licensing for insurance and all that. Maybe that's how it should be. You know, it's a very dangerous sport, and there needs to be a better chain of command. And I agree with you so much about the state-to-state nonsense. You know, there's different rules in terms of same-day weigh-ins. There's different, not really state-by-state, but that's more of like different commissions and different, you know, the IBF has their rules, which I know you don't like, and we're going to get onto that in a second. But all in all, unfortunate, obviously, terrible situation. It is not great for the sport, not especially after some of the headlines. You know, we're dealing with PEDs in boxing. Imagine now Morrell comes out. He's not on that, obviously. He's been drug tested, but in a situation where a fighter's on PEDs and he puts a fighter in a coma, then what? Then we're having a really bad conversation.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the reasons why we talk about this stuff, and it's one of the reasons why. I myself, and I know you are too, are so adamantly against PEDs because this is a dangerous, dangerous sport. This is the most dangerous sport in the world. We have more deaths in this sport than any other sport in the world, probably several of them combined. And it's just, yeah, PEDs are a whole nother story. And we've talked that to the death, and I'm sure we'll talk it again. You know, but yeah, it's just, this sport has no room for error. When it comes to these things, there's no room for cheaters. There's no room for the officials and the overseeing bodies to let things slide, or, you know, it sucks to see. This is one of those situations that hits hard, hits home. You know, I got a heavy heart tonight.
Yeah. I was very upset when I got the official word, because I was pretty upset watching the fight. And then I tweeted out afterwards. I was like, man, this Yerbosanelli tonight took a very rough beating. I'm pretty a scary beating. Went to sleep, didn't hear anything the following morning. You know, I'm not a journalist. I'm not a reporter. I wouldn't even know who to call. I figured someone was on it, and Dan Rafael was. He's one of the very best in the business. He's one of the only true journalists in boxing. Placed a call to the hospital. And that's when he started digging up, and that's when he started getting word that he's in a medically induced coma. And then I just lost it, man. Like, I was just like, it just hurt. Like, it was just tough. It's a tough headline, and it was just tough to watch that close. But it's important so we can figure out how to change this. And that's why we're doing this podcast too, or covering this, is to figure out solutions, because can't let it happen again. You know, it's a dangerous sport. It can happen with literally one punch, but there needs to be better precautions where fighters aren't failed like that. And I would ask you, Chris, like, you know a lot about, you know, the weight cut process. You know a lot about training. Obviously, that's your bread and butter. Is there anything that could be changed in the lead up to a fight, the training, to prevent this? I wouldn't say prevent, like, the fight's not being stopped on time, but preventing traumatic brain injuries. Can that be fixed before you step in the ring?
It can never be fixed. It can never be completely prevented.
I worded
prevented.
That wrong. I feel better prevented.
Yeah, 100%. And it can never be prevented, but, you know, it's part of the sport. And, you know, but there are certain things that you can look out for. I mean, a lot of fighters, the consequences of fight night often happen in the gym. There's a lot of the probably most of the damage that happens in a fighter's career happens in the gym. Sparring, really tough sparring sessions, gym wars, guys not wearing headgear when they spar to get prepared for professional fighting without headgear, which is silly. You know, and again, back to the gym wars, these guys who pride themselves on going hard in the gym. I mean, we don't get paid to go hard in the gym. We get paid on fight night. So saving it for fight night is really important. But listen, you got a long career. The rounds add up. There's only so much damage the human brain can take. The human brain is extremely, extremely fragile. There are certain things you can do to try and strengthen yourself in terms of proper strength and conditioning, strengthening, you know, your neck, being properly fueled and hydrated during your sessions. And which leads me into a perfect segue into hydration. We're talking about weight cuts, and you're talking about, you know, rehydration clauses and things that will limit a fighter's ability to rehydrate. So when they're going into the ring, they are their true selves and not a diminished athlete. When you are in a dehydrated state, what happens is your brain actually shrinks, which allows for more space within the cranium, within that cerebral spinal fluid space. With more space between your brain and your skull, allows for more movement. Your brain is literally like a big piece of jello that sloshes around inside your skull. A concussion happens when that jello hits the skull wall. So a lot of times you get hit, you have that movement, that whipping motion, those knockouts where you see a guy get hit in the chin, his head spins. The brain swirls around within that kind of a fishbowl and smacks against the side one way, smacks against the side the other way, which is why when you see a fighter hit his head on the ground on the way down, it's so dangerous. You get that second concussive impact after they've already been hit. Their brain has hit the wall so one way, and then hits the wall the other way as you hit or hit the ground. So you get that double impact, which is extremely, extremely dangerous. You know, so, and that's why you alluded to earlier, we don't see this as much in MMA, and MMA is considered safer when it comes to striking because the guys don't get hit as often. Also, the contest is not as long. A 12 round contest is 36 minutes of action. There's more time for that athlete to dehydrate over time. There's also a very stupid rule where they only allow water in the corner, and they only allow water to be consumed in the multiple hours prior to getting in the ring. This is very inside boxing or inside baseball. People that don't understand that, you're supposed to be, if you're a main event fighter, you're supposed to be there 3 hours before the main event. You're only allowed water while you're in there. No food, no drink, no caffeine, no Gatorade, no electrolytes, none of that.
Well, I always knew I always knew you couldn't drink anything else in the, like, it's water in the corner. Mm-hmm. Remember the black bottle? What fight was that? Mm-hmm.
That was Aaron Pryor and Alexis Arguello.
He had that special sauce in there, but I did not know you can only drink water in the 3 hours leading up to the fight.
And it's only the water provided by the commission. You know,
if you had your way, what would you be drinking and eating?
at the very least, sugar and like a electrolyte Gatorade, something like that. I ate something with carbohydrate in it so I can maintain my glycogen stores, maintain my electrolytes. You know, especially after a rough cut, you know, you've got a rough weight cut, you've got 24 hours to rehydrate properly. And, you know, sometimes you need every minute you have leading up to fight night. And fights are long, a 12 round contest, 36 minutes of action at the highest intensity level that you can ever see in sport, you know, is insane, you know. So for you to only be hydrating with water, as we know, is not enough when things are very, very difficult and high intensity. You know, it's really important that you're able to hydrate and fuel to keep yourself in you know, safe.
Do you ever get a reason why? Like, what's their reasoning behind that?
Pets, guys using stimulants prior to you know, prior to the contest. You know, so using uppers, using things that would be,
yeah,
know,
but if they bring in Gatorades, you can beat that. Yeah, so you can only have water. I honestly did not know that. And what do you think the reasoning is behind, or not the reasoning, but like, why couldn't they provide you guys with like Gatorades or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that had been done or been okayed in California. I believe when Fernando Vargas fought, it might have been one of the Shane Mosley fights or possibly Mayorga, he did have Gatorade in the corner because, you know, they especially requested that. But, you know, generally that's not allowed. New York, it's definitely not. They're very, very strict in New York about whatever you have, whatever you consume prior to the contest when you're in the back. And it's only the water provided by the commission, can't have anything else. And, you know, I understand the idea is that, you know, you could, it's very easy to put a stimulant in your drink. Literally, it could be a powder that is flavorless, odorless, colorless. Boop, you put it in your water bottle, boom, and you're ready to rock.
Yeah. But aren't they watching you pretty closely?
In New York, forget it. I mean, I fought almost all of my fights in my boxing career in New York, and it is the strictest commission in the world. They are following you everywhere you go. They are very adamant about making sure that they have eyes on you at all times. They follow you into the stall. They check out everything that you're drinking. You're only allowed the water that they have available, you know. So I have always said, I come on fight night, I step over the threshold into that back arena as the latest possible without getting literally phone calls from the promoter that, you know, it's time to, you know, what are you doing? The fight's not going to happen. I step over that threshold and I'm finishing my carbohydrate, protein drink, and my last sip of coffee. So I get my caffeine and my carbs in, and I step in and I go in, and it's just water until fight night. You know, it's honestly, as a sports nutritionist, someone who is very, very on top of my supplementation and my carbohydrate intake and nutrition in general, it's aggravating every single time for me. And I'm like, this sport could be better. We could be safer and the athletes could perform better. 36 minutes without any carbohydrate is a long time. It's a long time, especially at the high levels of intensity that boxing is contested at.
That's very interesting. Something I did not know. And it's very useful information for this conversation. It's something also I was thinking about is weight restrictions. We're talking about how you can never be able to prevent a traumatic brain injury in boxing, but there are ways that you can, you know, kind of make it more safe. And when it comes to it, there are a lot of fighters who fight way above their natural weight. We call them they call them weight bullies. You know, David Benavidez, for example, is a weight bully by definition. He probably walks around at 190, maybe even more, fights at 168 pounds. I don't know what he does in between fights. He probably has gotten better with it, but a lot of these guys walk around and they blow up in between fights and then they kill themselves to make the weight, like you said. And that's not a good thing to do because you become dehydrated. And you just spoke about what the dangers that does to the brain. What about this? In a perfect world, you would have to stay within 10% of your weight class or you're forced to move up. I know it'll never happen, but is there anything behind that in terms of you can't blow up in between fights where you have a ridiculous weight cut, which puts you, makes you dehydrated and makes your brain more likely or to receive really bad damage?
Well, number one, it would be nearly impossible to police that, how often you can check the fighters, but also, I mean, human beings are so different. Individuality amongst people is it's varied, it's wide. And some guys do gain a lot of weight. And listen, how are you going to compare a guy who gains, you look at him and he's, maybe he's 10% over his body weight, and but he's just chubby. He just got fat. He likes to eat his sweets and he just, you know, whatever. But then you got a guy who gets, who's, you know, 10% over and he's still just as ripped and he's got six pack abs and just filled in his muscles and he just put on some good weight. And now he's got to really restrict himself. So, you know, and you can lose body fat during training camp, depending on how long your training camp is. So like, if you're 3 months out, you can lose a tremendous amount of body fat in that time. So it would be impossible. I don't think it would be, you know, fair to do that. I don't know what the fix is. I don't. One method that they've been using to try and fix this is they're trying to do same day weigh-ins. I know the IBF has a rule about that. It's plus 10 pounds, which, first of all, it's an absolute number of plus 10 for every weight class, which makes absolutely no sense. If you're going to set that limit, it would have to be a percentage, because how can a 175 pounder be allowed 10 pounds to gain, but also a flyweight who's, you know, 112 or 108 be allowed to gain 10 pounds? It's a completely different number. So having it being arbitrary 10 pounds makes zero sense. Second of all, why are we limiting how much you can rehydrate in order to, every, like I said earlier, everyone's different in terms of what they need to feel like themselves and to make sure that the brain is hydrated. There's no arbitrary number for that either. You know, hydration status is different amongst everyone. Everyone's different depending on your lean muscle mass, depending on your body fat, depending on how you actually acquire that hydration leading back up to your natural weight. So making a fighter remain dehydrated overnight after weighing in, where you're going to allow 10 pounds, where a lot of fighters cut 15 or 20, even the week of a fight. You know, I don't like that idea. And I think it leads to fighters who are stressing themselves out the night before a fight, not getting that restful sleep that you really need in order for your brain to work properly, for your body, your muscles to recover. You're taking away from the sport and the athletes in general.
What is the FBI. What is the IBF's reasoning behind that?
Well, I think a lot of it comes from, honestly, there was a fight that comes to mind, Arturo Gatti, when he fought Joey Gamache. And I was actually at that fight as well. It was one of the most vicious, yeah, brutal knockouts you'll ever see.
That was a bad.
And, Gamache was essentially a 130 pounder. And I believe they fought at 140 pounds. And there was a lot of talk about Gotti actually never making the 140 pound. Like, he jumped on the scale as soon as it got to 40, he jumped off and then started guzzling water, and that he had gained over 20 pounds on fight night, that he was in the low to mid 160s. Yikes. And Joey Gamache was like 42, like 142 pounds. Like, he gained very, very little weight. And, you know, the size difference was insane. And it was very obvious. And Arturo not only was a much bigger man, but was a brutal puncher. He could really, really punch, had real knockout power, fighting a much smaller man who did not rehydrate to anywhere near the same size. And he took a vicious beating, a bad knockout. And that opened up a lot of people's eyes. Again, this was in New York. It was on the undercard of Oscar De La Hoya and I believe it was Coley. It was one of De La Hoya's comebacks. And brought a lot of eyes to that. And it made people think, oh, well, we can't have these guys who can gain 25 pounds between the weigh and the fight, you know, fighting these smaller guys. And there was an idea of going back to the same day weigh-in. I am adamantly against that, because again, we're talking about hydration. We're talking about being able to rehydrate the brain. Fighters are going to cut weight no matter what. I don't care what you tell them. I don't care if you tell them they got to weigh in and step in the ring. They're going to try and get any competitive advantage they can get. And the fact that everybody does it doesn't even really make it a competitive advantage as much as it levels the playing field. We don't see the drastic size differences in highly competitive fights at a higher level. The biggest difference I've ever seen was like Floyd Mayweather versus Canelo Alvarez when they fought many moons ago. And yeah, Canelo was the much bigger guy, much younger guy. Guess what? It didn't matter. It didn't matter. At that level, the size, you're not getting those mismatches where a guy's going to get hurt. Because at that level, those guys, everybody's good. They're good at protecting themselves. They're, mm-hmm, you know, it's a highly contested fight. It's competitive. It's not a champion versus a journeyman. That's where you see those injuries from guys being too big, not at the higher levels. So I think that the looking glass should not be at those types of fights in terms of the guy gaining too much weight. It should be, you know, guys not being able to rehydrate and to, especially at the higher levels.
Yeah, so that's maybe something that could be looked at in terms of before the fight even starts, before, you know, your weight cut like your sparring sessions that you talked about. No one's regulating sparring sessions. That's where all the damage happens. No. You know, when I did it,
your team, with Tris your team Dixon. Needs to be looking out.
Right. And then, like we said, that goes right back to your corner there. You can't, I put a lot of blame on everyone on Saturday night, but the least of it I would put on the corner because they're just too invested. They just want to win by any means. Same thing with these sparring sessions that I hear about that are, you know, that go on too long and they're too brutal and no one's regulating those. And talk to anyone in boxing, they'll tell you that, you know, the damage, most of the damage a fighter takes in their career is during sparring.
Everybody's got the stories of the gym wars and, you know, sparring multiple days in a row, sparring, 12, 15 rounds, doing 5-minute rounds, and you always want tough sparring. Like that's, you know, everybody says that, oh, I need some tough sparring. Like, yeah, but not every session should be tough. It shouldn't be 3 days a week. You're in with killers because you're getting killed. You're killing each other. That's what killers do. So, you know, granted, you got to be working your defense. But not everybody can do that. You know, I remember being in Robert Garcia's gym, and we were talking about Floyd Mayweather, and one of the boxers in the gym was like, "Ah, I don't like the way Floyd fights." And Robert basically said, he was like, "If you could fight like him, you would. You can't, so you don't." You know, and that's the reality of it. Defense is tough. Defense is the hardest part of the sport. You know, if everybody can go in there and fight without getting hit, they would, but that's just not the reality.
Yeah. Floyd will always say, "I left this game with all my faculties." You know, he says that it's like one of his catchphrases, a hell of a fighter. I left the sport with all my faculties, and yeah, because he didn't get hit, and it's really hard not to get hit. Like you said, obviously I brought up holding position, ringside position is more accountable. You know, they're the independent party here. They don't have any dog in the race. They're there without emotion. They should have a bigger say in the process of a fight that we think could get out of control being stopped. How about stricter punishments for rabbit punching? There was no rabbit punching in this fight, but there was in the Pritchard Cologne fight. He is now a name in the boxing world because he suffered a traumatic brain injury on a fight that he was. Got off to a really good start, was probably one of the first five rounds, started getting rabbit punched excessively. Complained to the referee. Referee said, "Deal with it yourself." Ridiculous. Complained about headaches or a headache to his corner. Corner didn't do anything. Goes out there. The fight ends in an odd fashion, and something with the gloves being taken off, something odd, but ends up the dude is now a vegetable. Like, he's still alive, but he went to a coma for over 200 days. You know, stuff like that. Like, I see rabbit punches all the time. Like, it didn't happen in this fight, but it's not enforced at all. Like, the judges don't, I mean, the refs don't do anything. There's very rarely points taken away. Like, that right there should be an easy fix.
Yeah, another fight that comes to mind is Mike McCallum and Nigel Benn from the early 90s. A lot of rabbit punching in that fight as well. Him complaining to the ref saying, you know, back of the head multiple times throughout. Yeah, rabbit punching is tough because you're supposed to cut the body down perfectly down the ears, and that becomes a legal area to strike. You know, behind that is not so much, but you know, you're hitting with a rounded glove. It's not the most precise thing when you're looking at it. So when you're getting hit, like, oh, did that hit on the ear? Did that hit behind the ear? Did that hit on his neck? You know, and sometimes punches will often slide off, you know, of gloves and this and that. It's a very, you know, these are all difficult questions. They're all difficult fixes. Rabbit punching, unless they're really, really blatant, is probably, you know, one of the harder ones to call. But yeah, I don't know the fix for that one either. You know, this sport is tough, man.
I feel as helpless as I did Saturday night.
Yeah. The action's live. The action's fierce. Yeah.
You know, trying to come up with solutions for this. I mean, those are just three that came to the top of my mind. The weight stuff, physicians, enforcing some of the rules a little more. Referees will be a little more. This is how it always happens, though. Like after the Magomed, Pritchard Cologne, Daniel Franco. Now this one.
Patrick Day. Patrick Day was a good friend of mine, someone I've known for a long time. Patrick was a different case, right? Patrick was in a very competitive fight. not so much scoring wise. He was losing the fight because he got dropped a couple times, but he was in the fight fighting, and he was landing, and he was there.
Right.
I think the issue with Pat was having too many tough fights in a row. And Pat is a really interesting case, because I know Pat personally. Pat's a guy who stays in shape year round. He never gets out of shape, but that was a detriment as well, because he stayed in the gym. He had a very, very tough fight with the Dominican fighter, who's fantastic. He just beat Derevchenko.
Adames,
right? And Adames is a beast. And Pat went 10 rounds with Adames. And then 3 months later, he gets a call to fight. I'm drawing a blank on the name, but
he shouldn't.
Do you think
that
Pat stayed out of the gym?
No,
it's too close. Way too close. So, do you think Pat stayed out of the gym from sparring? No, of course. Oh, I got a fight. I got a big fight. This is my career. I got to do it. And he went back to the gym and he started sparring again. We talked about the damage that happens during sparring, and he fought two killers back to back, two serious punchers, and he's got. And then you add up the two camps, and it's a very short period of time. And Pat, again, like you said, he's a very healthy guy. He's in shape. You think the best. He's in the fight. He's competitive. He's losing, but he's fighting every moment. And one punch, and you know, it was one shot, and he just never woke up. So you've got so many different ways for things to go bad. But I do believe there's always signs, and whether it's in the ring itself or it's in the camp or prior.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, the fighter's in there alone, but man, it takes a village. It takes a team. It takes a pit car crew for a fighter to make it to fight night and to make it out of fight night, you know, healthy. So like we keep saying, there's a lot of lines of defense in order to protect that fighter without leaving just upon them and their skills.
Yeah. I mean, that's the, you know, summary of this whole conversation is that there isn't one way to fix it without totally like neutering the sport or getting rid of it. It's just, there's so many different signs out of the ring. Like you said, inside of the ring. Saturday night, it seemed like they were all right there in front of you. That's what makes it even more egregious. And that's what makes it even more upsetting. Yeah, man, I was just, it really got to me on Saturday. And, you know, I haven't felt like this since the Golovkin-Derevchenko fight, which I was at ringside, and it was one of the most grueling fight I've ever seen ringside. Yeah. And I remember walking away saying, like, why do I do this? Like, I don't even fight. Like, why does anyone come here to watch this? Why? It's just so... Like, there are moments like this. Like, I think if you have a conscience, you feel the same way. Obviously, the highs are awesome, like great fights. And for the most part, I maintain that. I'm sure you feel the same way, Chris. Like, boxing saves more lives than it takes. Their highs are awesome in the sport. But this is the one side of the sport no one really wants to discuss. But it seems to be happening way too much lately. And it sucks. There is no real fix. You just hope that at the least, we don't see another repeat of what we saw on Saturday, when the signs are right there, when it is 100-punch difference in landed shots, the swelling on the face, the blinking, the fact that he was not going to win the fight, the fact that he was carried to his corner by the other fighter, no oxygen. I mean, geez. I mean, it just, come on. No, ringside position. Like, we can go through it over and over. Like, that was bad. We got to fix that where everyone can see, you know, the stuff that you talked about, the weight cutting, sparring fans don't see that. You know, people outside the sport don't see that. People saw what happened Saturday night, whether they weren't watching or they found out about it because TMZ reports on it. And it's just bad. It's not good for the sport.
Yeah. I mean, we're both here because boxing truly is the best sport in the world, but we've got a really good way of punching ourselves in the eyes and giving ourselves black eyes for everybody else to see very, very often. And seems like, I don't know, we're just going through a rough stint at the end of this year. We've got a lot of black eyes. But you know, you're usually the optimist, but I feel like, you know, the good things of the sport are still there. You know, the lives that are saved are still there. The magic moments are still there, and we're going to see many more of those. It's just tough because this is so in our face, and it's
yeah,
you know, it's the proximity of it is tough. But that's why we do this. We're talking about this when it's raw.
Yeah, exactly. So everyone's got to do their job so we can enjoy those big moments. You know, referees do your job, physicians do your job, corners fighters, all that. Everyone needs to do a drop so we can have more of those fun nights. So, yeah, a segment that I think is very important, and I hope a lot of fans understood some of the intricacies of it. There are some fights this weekend. You're heading out to Cleveland, right? Cleveland? With Justin
Sunny,
Shackle.
Beautiful Cleveland, Ohio.
Getting out of the hurricane. You're going to be with Shackle. You're going to be with Erdman, Claudia Trejos. That's one of the fights this weekend. We're going to see Montana Love in there with Stevie Sparks. What do you know about this card? It seems like it's not the biggest names, but they seem like evenly matched.
Yeah, they're not the biggest names, and they're not the guys that are really like deep into their career, like in terms of being top contenders. But there's a lot of good matchups and a lot of fights that potentially could not only be competitive, but we can see some upsets.
Yeah, that's the DAZN card this weekend. Not the biggest fight weekend. November is pretty scarce besides the 26th Cepeda in Prograis. But you got Sonny Edwards fighting on Friday night against Felix Alvarado. Sonny Edwards is the champ at 112. Fan Rodriguez is going down to 112. These two have been circling each other for a while. Felix Alvarado is a pretty tough opponent. So Edwards gets through that. Maybe we can see Bam versus Edwards at 112. That's something I would want to see.
Yeah, and I think this is something that we see in the lighter weights. Matchups get made. You know, like we see these guys. If they want each other, they happen. You know, there's not a lot of wiggle room. There's no ducking. So as long as Edwards does his job, then I believe we'll be seeing that Bam fight pretty soon.
Yeah, it was a discussion about our fighter of the year debate last on Monday's episode. That's got taken to the Twitter world, and it's very like I'm starting to think maybe Bam might win it. I my pick was Bivol,
which is a very good pick,
right? Of course, and this is like revisionist history now on who Zerto is. Like, did Bivol make him look like he did, or was he overrated to begin with? That starts to creep into your mind. Obviously, the Canelo win should be enough. But he was also, Canelo was, you know, definitely undersized. But on the flip side of that, no one was picking Bivol. I mean, a few were. I think you said maybe Bivol can give him trouble, but no one was really like putting their chest out and saying that Canelo was going to beat Bivol. So there's a way you could break that down. Then you look at Bam, three fights, like jumping up in weight. So that discussion, I'm interested to see who's going to win Fighter of the Year.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I said, you know, last episode. I went out on a limb, I thought, at the time, but I guess in hindsight, it's maybe not so much on a whim, because I was looking deep into the wins, you know, like again, the Quadras taking it on short notice, jumping up two weight classes, his first world title fight. That's badass. That gets my respect. And then to come back and do what he did to Rongvisai, and granted, his third fight wasn't spectacular at all. You know, he still beat a top guy, you know, so I like busyness, you know, and Bivol had his two fights, and I get it. We know at the highest level, especially again, in those higher weights, it's different. It takes longer to make fights. Great wins, Canelo, obviously, but yeah, I hate to do it, but I had the same feeling with Deserto. I'm like, was that guy that good? Cause going into it, I'm like, ooh, it's a tough fight. He's physically, his size, his length, southpaw, undefeated, good skill. You know, like this is a tall task, and it wasn't.
Yeah,
you know, it makes you think, like, is Zerto really that guy? You know, what are his best? You know, he struggled with Jesse Hart twice, you know, back at 68. He beat Sullivan Barrera in very impressive fashion. But I was in camp with Sullivan, and I know that, you know, he was off for a long time and was coming back, and, you know, he had some injuries that he was dealing with. So he's also an older fighter. Yeah. So yeah, when you look past the numbers, is it as impressive? That's why I'm still sticking with Bam.
That's going to be interesting. We're going to see that at the end of the year, who they pick for that one. Other fights this weekend, we got Janabek, the one name monster at 160 now, fighting in the main event on ESPN. Sinisa Estrada makes her top ranked debut. That's over on ESPN. Let me get into the exhibitions, Chris, the exhibitions. I put this tweet out yesterday. Ricky Hatton, Marco Antonio Barrera, and Floyd Mayweather are all fighting this weekend. And the replies were hilarious. Like, what year is this? Let me fire up HBO. You know, like, this is lit.
Well, is that why you were wearing the HBO sweatshirt? Is that why you got the HBO sweatshirt? You're going back 1973?
This is why I was wearing it. I also tweeted the video, the opening of the HBO theme. you know, the HBO theme song with the open animation.
Oh, so good.
All right. I ran through a wall and I tweeted, who's the one fighter when you hear that music? Who do you think of? And the answers were awesome. To me, it's probably either Oscar or Floyd. What would you say?
For me, it's going to be Oscar because that's the first guy. Oh, no. Roy Jones. Roy Jones. I think about Roy Jones, man. During that heyday in the 90s. Yeah, Roy and Oscar were the two guys in the 90s that I saw fight the most. And Roy, I mean, dude. Ronnie, have you gone back and watched Roy yet? Have you looked at the highlights of Roy Jones Jr. yet?
You do your homework, Ronnie?
Yes. I did watch Roy Jones highlights, and it's just absolutely insane. It's not real.
He's Michael Jordan with boxing gloves on. It's insane. He's tapping his ankle and cracking a guy. He's rolling this arm, hitting you with that arm. He's throwing left hooks from one corner to the other. He's knocking guys out with one punch. He's knocking you out with his hands behind his back. I mean, God, there's nobody like Roy.
Remember when he fought at Radio City? Right, he fought at Radio City Music Hall. The guy to do it. There was another one. I think Donaire and Rigondeaux fought like 10 years after that.
I was there for that.
I was on the stage. I wasn't missing that one because I was too young for when Roy fought, or I just didn't go to that one. But
who did he fight at Radio City?
I think Harmon or David Telesco. I think it was David Telesco. It was a one.
I was thinking
it was pretty much a Roy, you know, easy win.
Yeah, he dominated.
But the best part about it was he came out from like a side door and there was like steps and he came out with Method Man and Red Man. And Roy was on mic and he was rapping and he had like this, he had the tuxedo robe.
My God.
He had like, it wasn't like a robe, but it was like a tuxedo, but it was like cut off sleeves because it was Radio City and like that's where we wear the Radio City. And it was, he was like, I think him and Oscar, I believe Oscar had the most HBO appearances of any fighter ever.
Yeah.
Because before they even went to full pay-per-view, it was Oscar like five times a year, certain years.
Because he was knocking everybody out. He was knocking everyone out. So he needed like zero recovery time between fights.
Yeah, pretty much. But that was the deal.
Who did Roy fight? Here's a little trivia question. Who did Roy fight, but he played an amateur basketball game
the
same afternoon?
Another legend, Ronnie. Roy Jones played an amateur basketball game during the day and then fought at night. That's how good he was.
Really?
Like, yeah. Borderline disrespectful.
A world title fight.
I remember I didn't go to
that's one. That's one for the Twitterverse.
I remember my dad was talking about that when he came home from that fight. Like, you always come home Sunday after being away for the whole weekend, and he would be like, I remember him telling me about Roy Jones, and I remember him vividly telling me about Manny Pacquiao. Like when he watched Pacquiao's first win on 2001 on HBO, where he was like, a late replacement. Yeah. And he said, you got to watch this guy Pacquiao. He's going to be a major force. Yeah, those were the HBO days. But you're going to relive them this weekend if you really want to. Ricky Hatton versus Marco Antonio Barrera. This one is at least there's some charity involved with it. Hatton lost a ton of weight because he was at least 250 at one point last year. He slimmed down. Barrera, obviously legend, they're doing it for some type of charity, but it's already sold out over in the UK. Then you got Floyd Mayweather fighting Deji. Are you familiar with Deji, Ronnie?
No, doesn't ring a bell.
A YouTuber with 3 million subscribers. DAZN was pumping up his subscriber count. That's a new one for me, Chris. You got Tail of the Tape. I'll give you every punch stat. They were like, the graphic for this one was 3 million Instagram 3 million Instagram followers, which is a million more than Lomachenko, who's number two as a boxer, not Ryan Garcia, who has 9 million. That's where we're at with Floyd.
Last I checked, this was boxing. It doesn't matter, your followers aren't in the ring with you. Who gives a shit?
It's crazy, man. I was saying Floyd, I still adamant about this. Floyd doing exhibitions it's cool. It's not unprecedented. It's been done before. You know, only a select few can do it, like the Barreras, the Hattons, to a lesser degree. Pacquiao's not getting into the exhibition. You know, Ali has done it. But I'm starting to wonder a little bit why Floyd is doing so many of them. Obviously, money comes to mind first. And it's also like, obviously, Floyd also likes to be in the limelight. But it's not like these are doing like crazy numbers. It's not like they're doing like the whole boxing world stopping what they're doing to watch what Floyd is doing. He's doing it because he's getting like these ridiculous paydays. And this one is in Dubai. He's getting 10, 15 million just for these four round. They're not even exhibitions. They're not even sparring. It's like below sparring at this point with Deji. So it's like, why is he doing these? It's got to be a money thing.
I mean, listen, one of the fastest ways to spend your wealth is to gamble. And we do know that he likes to gamble. So it could be that. It could be that he's just bored. This is all he's ever done. You know, like, yeah. This is what he knows. This is what he loves to do. And he understands that age is real, but these guys can't hurt him. And he knows that. You know, I'm sure his sparring is very, very specific, and it's curated, and he's curating his opponents. These guys can't hurt him. And he knows that, and he can make $15 million doing it, $10 million doing it for a sparring session. Listen, everybody's done it. All these guys have come back. All the major stars in the sport over the years have done it. Ali did it. Tyson's done it, where you watch him work out and he gets trained. He fought Roy Jones. Like, they all do it. And listen, make that money again. I mean, he made more money than everybody, you know, anyone. He definitely doesn't, maybe shouldn't need the money, but who knows? You know, every man has the, they can spend their money any way they want. So
right. They have the right to earn, and he's still a name. And, you know, there's people in Dubai, or when he goes to Japan, and they've never seen him fight. That's kind of cool. But part of me was like, man, like, he's doing so many of them. Like, I've like maybe one a year, but he's on like a circuit now. He's pretty much like more active now than he was during his actual career.
Oh, absolutely. He used to fight twice a year, sometimes once, you know, when he was in those big fights. But these fights, they're not fights of that. Sugar Ray Robinson did it. He did his international tour. He did his tour of Europe and was fighting wherever. He fight, you know, once every couple weeks and whatnot. Yeah. Like you said, people haven't seen him fight. I remember my martial arts instructor, who was a kickboxer way back, and then took like 15 years off. And then he said, you know, my kids never got to see me fight live, so I want to fight. And I was like, oh, I respect that. And he came back with two fights, but he fought really tough guys. Don't do that. Do what Floyd's doing.
Yeah, do Floyd. Fight Deji, the Dejis of the world. And Tommy Fury's on the card. I bring him up because I think we both want to see him fight Jake Paul. Jake Paul will be there. I think Jake Paul is friends with Deji. They come from the YouTuber world. I also think Jake Paul's there too. If Fury wins, he'll get in his face. He will do the theatrics and build towards a Tommy Fury Jake Paul fight, which I think should happen in the UK. So that is this weekend. A little bit of something for everyone. 112-pound fights. You got Janibek. You got Estrada. You got Montana Love. Where Chris will be on the call. You got Mayweather, Hatton, Marco Antonio Barrera. Wow. A smorgasbord of weirdness and the sport that we love. The WBC convention also this weekend. You ever been to a convention, Chris?
Multiple. Yeah. A bunch of different ones.
Like a mixture between a big ass party and the most boring PowerPoint presentations ever.
Well put. And for anyone who has never been to one, they have no idea what it's like. But that's what it is. It's a big party with a lot of celebrities. It's boxing celebrities. You're going to see people from, you know, decades ago. You're going to see the hottest new prospects. You're going to see world champions. You're going to see legends of yesteryear. And you're going to see stupid bureaucratic talks about who should be ranked where and why.
Yes.
And promoters standing up being like, why guys should be number two. And oh my gosh.
I watched the live stream of it, and it was like petitioning. Our boy Alex Dombroff was petitioning. The first days of petitioning about why my guys should be ranked here. Why guys that were on PEDs should be fit back into the rankings. It is interesting to watch a little bit if you're like really into how the sausage is made in the boxing world. But also, like, the first night was like this big party on the beach. It's the 60th edition of the WBC convention. And, you know, I think the green belt's probably one of the most prestigious ones. But, like, you really got a glimpse of where these sanctioning fees are going when you see the budgets they have for these parties, right?
Yeah, I've been to some parties that were not related to conventions that were, you know, related to the bodies or people in the bodies.
Yeah.
There's the money is being spent in fun ways.
That's what I mean. Say. You can see that. Like, you can tangibly see it. Every sanctioning fee over the last whatever years is put into those parties. But there is some stuff comes out of it. Today, or when we record today, is the day where they do the mandatories. And a lot of fights that are either have been announced already, or some fights that are already could be in motion, a lot of fights that aren't even going to happen. Deontay Wilder versus Andy Ruiz was approved or ordered today. Errol Spence, Keith Thurman was ordered today. I think Wilder Ruiz will probably happen. Spence Thurman, we've heard the rumors through the grapevine. Wouldn't be surprised if that one happens. WBC ordered Benavidez versus Plant. That fight's already in motion. And I think Benavidez's handler, Samson Lukowicz, said it's happening in March, not January. So that was a little nugget today. This one has, I would put it at negative percent chance of happening. Stevenson versus Isaac Cruz. Love to see it. Stevenson's with top rank. Isaac Cruz is with PBC. That one's never going to happen. Teofimo Sandor Martin, probably not going to happen. Fundora versus Tony Harrison, like that one. Maybe that could happen, both with PBC. And then Fulton versus, right. And then Fulton versus Figueroa too. But it was also revealed that Fulton is moving up to 126.
Oh.
And yes. Hmm. And another thing too, Chris, Inoue was, it was revealed, Mauricio Suleiman pretty much said Inoue is his next fight in December at 118 will be his last at 118. He's going to 122. So everyone was like, oh, great. So now we can get Fulton versus Inoue at 122, because exactly. if Inoue wins that last belt, the WBO one, they have that clause where if you win a WBO belt and you move up, you can automatically fight the champion, the WBO champion in the next weight class, and that's Fulton. But then it comes out today that Fulton's moving to 126.
Yeah, that's news to me. I like the Fulton Inoue fight. I think Fulton stylistically is probably the only guy who could figure out a way to win against Inoue. Otherwise, yeah. I think Inoue is a bad, bad, bad man. He's an assassin in there. But Fulton, like I said, stylistically, the matchup is there, and I can see a way for him to prepare a game plan in order to win that fight. But I guess that ain't happening.
Fulton's bigger. Yeah,
he's bigger, too.
He's more active in terms of volume. But Inoue has that equalizer. I'd probably favor Inoue, but this doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. In this one. All right. Yeah. That's all the news for this week. Ronnie, casual corner. Ronnie, what do you got for us? We'll end the show on a funny note because it's been a very serious show, but a very important one. So Ronnie's casual corner is back.
Guys, wow. I'm back. you know, the shades are back. Let's get casual one time. I don't know if you guys saw this. I know Dan saw this, but Chris, let me know if you saw this as well. Daniel Cormier was on First Take today, and he had a top five fighters of all time. And for those that don't know, I'm just going to read out the list, and then I want to get your thoughts on this list. So this is not MMA fighters, not boxers. It is fighters. Number one, Floyd Mayweather Jr. Number two, Khabib Nurmagomedov. Number three, the greatest, Muhammad Ali. Number four, George St. Pierre. And number five, Amanda Nunes. I'm just going to let you guys take it away. Thoughts?
Well, I saw this on Twitter, and I audibly gasped. And it takes a lot on my Twitter feed, the amount of boxing accounts that I follow, for me to audibly gasp. It is one of the most ridiculous lists I've ever seen. And I like Daniel Cormier. You have any run-ins with Daniel Cormier, Chris?
No. I like a lot of his takes. I like his breakdowns. I think he's a great commentator, fantastic fighter. I had a run-in with him when I was in high school. He wrestled one of my high school wrestling coaches who was still competing at the time at the world level. So I got to see him actually compete as a wrestler long before he ever put on any kind of MMA gloves.
Legend. Guy's a legend. Legend. I liked him when he fought John Jones, and he was getting clowned for like crying after, and everyone was all over him. But I like that. I like Daniel Cormier a lot. This is like the most ESPN First Takey list I've ever seen. How do you combine boxers with MMA fighters? One sport's been around for what, 200 years? The other sport's been around for 30 years. So it's going to be top heavy with fighters, boxers. That's number one. Number two is he had freaking Khabib ahead of Ali.
What's the criteria, though? Like, is it accomplishment? What are we doing here? Is it accomplishment? Is it pound for pound if they fight each other?
Dude, am I watching that? You think I was thinking, watch that segment?
I thought when you first started, I was like, oh, who's like the baddest man on the planet? We had the fight. Who's going to win in a fight? Listen, I got John Jones, number one. Number two is Tyson Fury. Those two guys are beating everybody on the planet. But yeah, no, the criteria on that makes zero sense. I can't even decipher where he's going.
If I was going to put one MMA fighter on my list, obviously my list is going to be very boxing heavy, and Floyd Mayweather, I hate to break it to fans out there, it probably isn't even in my top 10 fighters of all time. He's in the definitely 10 to 20 with Pacquiao as well. Ronnie's just like, wow. Mm-hmm. Can't believe
and they should be right next to each other, honestly.
Right. Being in the top 20 fighters of all time is like a huge honor. Like, the sport has been around for like 200 years. Like, being in the top 20 is like you are like the 0.1% of the entire sport. So he's got Floyd number one. He's got Khabib two, which is hilarious. Ali three. George St. Pierre, Amanda Nunes. I mean,
how about he's only got two boxers in the whole list?
It's like the two most popular. Obviously, Ali belongs on the list. But Ali is the most popular.
Nunes, her career run wasn't even that long. You know, it was long for MMA because they knock each other off all the time. But like, yeah, she just got beat. She came back to win her title, but still.
The cockamamie list. Right, Ronnie?
It makes zero sense. I don't know even where he was going. He was throwing darts in the dark at that.
I think that he showed up to the set at First Take in New York City because everyone's here in New York City for the UFC. I'm going on Saturday night. I think he showed up and they were like, "We need you to make a top five fighters of all time." And he was like, "Ah, shit."
Across sports.
Yeah, across two different sports, one that's been around for only 30 years. And he was like, fuck, Mayweather, Khabib, and just started rattling them off as he was going to get like a coffee or something in the green room. That I hopefully that's, you know, and I tweeted
it out.
Not
surprised he didn't put John Jones, his conqueror, in there because he's one of the best fighters who's ever lived in terms of, you know, who can beat who. And the guy, he's a bad
one of my replies was that he only, the replies are hilarious, but one of the replies that I got was he was only putting fighters that did not test positive for PEDs.
Okay.
I mean,
who got caught for not testing positive for PEDs. Right.
We could do a whole nother PED episode, but it's those who have not got caught because
we will. I'm sure we will. it's a never ending problem in the sport.
Yes. So that was a funny list. Saw it today. Casual MMA fan Dan will be heading to the Garden Saturday night. Got a suite with my MMA Island friends. My brother Nick will be there celebrating his 40th birthday. I might take my shirt off. Might pop my shirt off. Be just
send pictures.
Pop it off.
I might just get into the
growing season.
I might get into the whole cosplay of being an MMA fan. Rip the shirt off, shave my head, maybe.
I think that should be our spinoff show, the casual MMA fan.
We do a casual MMA segment. Corner. I might show up tomorrow. I think I have a press pass to one of the events and, I don't know, cause a ruckus, talk to Dana. I'm excited, though. All jokes aside, like, I respect every fighter that steps in a cage or a ring. This card's loaded. Poirier.
Loaded, good card.
Chandler, sick fight. Israel Adesanya with Pereira, sick.
Both
fight.
Are my boys, by the way. They're fighting each other, Chandler and Poirier. I've sparred with Poirier.
Who are you
I've
for?
Known Mike for 10 yeah, years. For? I can't root for you. They're both my dudes. I can't even root. I think it's gonna be an awesome fight. It's a great matchup.
It's gonna be fireworks. Then you got the women's fight, Zalai versus I'm butchering names, but I'm on them. I'm just casual. I mean, I'm allowed to butcher names.
Casual Dan.
Yeah, exactly. Casual MMA guy. And then the guy starting it off, Dan, who's the guy starting it off tonight? I should know this. UFC 281. Hooker? Dan Hooker is always in good fights. He is the
always
first fight of the
fights.
Night. He's and then Frankie Edgar's on the card.
Oh,
we
want to
see. Yeah. We want to I think it's
Jersey,
his last
Jersey
fight.
Zone.
I think it's his last
Jersey Zone.
Yeah, it's his last hurrah. This is the guy that was fighting before it was even legal in
yeah, he's been around longer than me.
Yeah, he's been around forever. His last fight didn't go well. His last couple fights didn't go well. Frankie Edgar. Yeah, he became like, did you see the picture of him and he got kicked in the face? He turned into a Simpsons character.
Yeah.
Insane. Yeah. Insane. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want to see that. Kicks,
I tell people all the time, man, kicks are different. Kicks are car accidents. It's not like getting punched. Kicks are a whole different thing.
I don't even know how to apply to that. I've never been kicked.
I don't miss being kicked.
You haven't been kicked in a long time, Chris, right?
Yeah, very long time.
And you used to do the kicking.
Like, not like in a fight. Yeah, I miss kicking. I love kicking people, but yeah, I don't miss getting kicked at all.
I think we're talking with Zoe today. Zoe, shout out, one of our We Got Ice guys at the office, and he was explaining how much he loves kickboxing. And I was like, well, Algieri was a freaking 20-0 champ.
Sports to watch. Yeah,
it really is an insane sport to watch. We did stats for it. It was really hard to keep up with it.
It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal. It's so fast paced. It's brutal, and the power is stupid.
Knees, kicks. We had buttons for knees, buttons for kicks, and then button. Obviously, the hand striking, and sometimes it was happening in like all at once. They would do it all.
Yeah, listen. You know what doesn't happen? You know what doesn't happen in boxing? Guys don't break their forearms blocking punches. Guys don't break their shin bones kicking. Like, that's how hard these guys kick. Guys break their elbows, I broke my elbow in a fight. It's a brutal kick, right? Yeah, blocking. If you block with one arm, your arm, a good kicker, you're going to break your arm. You literally have to block with two hands. You can't block with one.
Oh, wow.
Guys kick way too hard, and shins are sharp.
Love that. Yeah, so I'll be over at MSG. I'll be following the fights this weekend. I'll turn on DAZN on my phone to see your mug and shackles and Claudia and
Erdman.
Ronnie, what do you got going on this weekend?
This weekend might be in the warehouse doing some stuff for the company. You know me. It's the warehouse.
Company man. Ronnie Giroux.
Grinding.
As always. All right, everybody. Important conversation today. Next week, we'll be breaking down more fights, talking about the ridiculousness of the sport and everything that comes along with it. I forgot my catchphrase again. Protect yourselves at all times. Stay out of DMs. We out.